Schreiber v. The insurance company. And somewhere I will have a piece of paper that's going to tell me. Yes, right here. Representing Hinshaw and Culbertson is attorney Susan R. Tyndall. Ms. Tyndall, you are representing the plaintiffs.
Representing the defendant's position.
Oh, you are. Okay. Do that then.
Good morning. I'm Susan Tyndall of Hinshaw and Culbertson. I represent Dr. Figge, Physicians Insurance Company of Wisconsin, and the Wisconsin Patients Compensation Fund. The principal issue before the court today is whether a patient has a right to compel a physician to perform a surgical procedure that the physician does not, at that time, recommend and does not desire to perform. And in order to answer the questions arising out of this issue, we first have to consider several questions. And the first one is, does this case present an issue within the scope of the doctrine of informed consent? The answer is no. The doctrine of informed consent, as case after case discusses, is concerned with disclosure of information, and the trial court concluded that the patient in this case had been provided with the appropriate information, that the disclosures were not inadequate, and that therefore the doctor's obligation under the doctrine of informed consent was met. Therefore, this doesn't present the classic informed consent case where the issue is whether or not the patient had enough information. The next question this court should consider is, well, should this case be held to come within the doctrine of informed consent? Or, to put it another way, should we extend the doctrine of informed consent to compelling a physician to perform a surgical procedure he or she doesn't desire to perform if that's what the patient desires? Again, I would submit that the answer is no. Why not? Well, that brings me to question number three that I think that the court needs to consider, and that is, what is the right of bodily integrity that the doctrine of informed consent, and before that, the history of assault and battery, was designed to protect? If you read the cases, the doctrine of bodily integrity that the informed consent doctrine is designed to protect is a person's right to be free of unauthorized intrusions or unauthorized contact. It's not a right to be able to tell another person that they have to do what you want or that they have to touch you in a certain manner that you desire. It's a right only to be free of unauthorized intrusion.
Does it implicate the right of the patient to tell the doctor, don't touch me where I don't want to be touched?
Exactly. That's what the doctrine has been all along. And if you look at the historical underpinnings of this, initially we had the doctrine of assault and battery that just is a plain and simple tort and criminal concept, where a person has a right to be free of threats of violence and or unauthorized touching, and has a right to be free of that unauthorized contact. And a battery, as we know, doesn't have to be a harmful, painful contact, but it can be just a simple contact as long as that contact is unauthorized and has a harmful intent. It's usually the doctrine of battery in its historical concept did require intent to inflict a harm. It didn't have to be a painful harm, but a harm of unauthorized contact. You can't just be a pat on the back. That doesn't qualify. But
what we have here, as you're framing the question, we arguably, there is an argument advanced that the contact was unauthorized because the patient said she wanted a different procedure. That's an argument that's advanced. If that argument is accepted, that it is unauthorized contact, then why doesn't the doctrine, the common law doctrine of bodily integrity, play a role in this case? That is, as you define it in your opening comments, the doctrine of bodily integrity is a person's right to be free of unauthorized intrusion.
Well, I think that's exactly what the issue has become now, but that's not the case that was tried. And that because this issue of unauthorized contact was raised first on appeal, and as a matter of fact, it was first raised at the oral argument on appeal and has been continued now, this is an improper issue to consider. The case that was tried was the classic informed consent case, where the plaintiff contended that she didn't have sufficient information about the risk of a VBAC and that, therefore, the doctor violated his duty in going ahead with the VBAC or having her consent to it. Further, in the middle of the day, when she was in labor, she requested a C-section, and the plaintiff's contention was that at that time, the request for the alternate mode of treatment, in her opinion, triggered a new informed consent duty, and that was an issue that was discussed, and then whether or not that raised as a matter of law an obligation of the doctor to offer a choice again. And the trial court held that she had been fully informed and that there was no change in her circumstances that necessitated that she be given a new opportunity to select anew in the middle of the day. So the issues that were tried wasn't whether he had committed an unauthorized procedure upon her, but whether she had been given enough information at these various times in the day. And the trial court, and you'll note the decision, is very careful and very detailed. It was tried to the court. There were post-trial briefs. And the trial court's decision analyzes all of the issues. And the issue of whether or not there was a battery committed upon her by, for example, I think currently the argument is that the administration of Pitocin constitutes a battery. Well, there was no finding of fact on that issue because that wasn't an issue. And when you look at the plaintiff's appeal brief, the only issue is, does she have a right to require this doctor to perform the procedure that she wanted? There wasn't an issue of, did he commit a battery by giving her Pitocin in the middle of the day when she had said, gee, I want a C-section now.
Well, if the answer to the question, did she have a right to insist on a particular treatment, is yes, she did, then the fact that another treatment was given, isn't that a battery as unauthorized?
I don't think that necessarily logically follows. I mean, there was no finding of fact as to what was going on, and there's no particular testimony as to what this lady's response was, either from her or from Dr. Figge or from her husband, with respect to when they discussed the Pitocin. There's no particular testimony in the record about what she said. Her testimony was, with respect to the Pitocin issue, that she heard them in the background talking about it, that they were going to give it to her, but no one specifically discussed it with her. But she knew that they were planning on giving it to her. The doctor's testimony was that he discussed it with her and told her that he thought it was appropriate, but there was no indication of what her response was. That wasn't the question that was asked, because battery at that time wasn't an issue.
Can you tell us what Pitocin does, what the purpose of Pitocin is?
When you're in labor, your body manufactures a hormone called oxytocin, and that causes contraction. And Pitocin is a man-made version of oxytocin that causes contractions, and when the doctor gives it during the labor, it just causes the contractions to be stronger. Mrs. Shriver had Pitocin, the man-made hormone, delivered in her first labor, and she had been familiar with it from having it previously.
Let me ask you something else. When she indicated at 1 o'clock in the afternoon that she wanted a C-section, why could that not be interpreted as a withdrawal of consent for the BAC approach?
Well, the record is complete, is replete with references from the experts that say a lot of people in labor ask for cesarean sections due to pain. The testimony is undisputed from all the physicians that it is not appropriate for a physician to do a cesarean section solely because of pain. That's not a medical indication for a cesarean section. And so all of the experts agreed that when a patient requests a C-section in the middle of labor, the doctors take time to talk to them and assess where the patient is at to make sure that, you know, that the patient is considering what's really going on and isn't making a decision that's driven by pain. And so I think that the doctors consider it not necessarily a withdrawal of consent, but a request for a procedure that they then consider and discuss in light of the patient's condition at the time.
Are the circumstances not somewhat different here, though, because you have a woman who had two prior C-sections, apparently because labor had not progressed as was expected? Doesn't that change the situation somewhat?
No. And the reason is, she had one C-section for her first pregnancy. Her labor had not progressed, and after like 36 hours, they performed a C-section. Her second C-section was an elective C-section because at the time, that's what they did. You had a C-section, so they did an elective. So the second time, she did not have labor. This time, she wasn't in labor for that length of time. As the trial court noted, he concluded that these pregnancies were different. But if you look at the expert testimony, all of the experts also agreed on this point. The least amount of risk is to have a vaginal delivery. The second most, or the second least amount of risk is to have an elective C-section, because it's generally a fairly safe procedure. Where the most risk to the patient comes in is where the patient has been in labor and then has a C-section. So there is an increase of risk that is presented when the patient has had a trial of labor and then says, gee, now I think I've changed my mind and want a C-section. That's a different situation than when she's sitting in the doctor's office 2 weeks before the surgery, or 2 weeks before she goes into labor, saying, I think I want a C-section. There's a different level of risk that's presented at that point. And so when the patient is in the middle of labor and says, I want a cesarean section because this hurts, and that's what, it's undisputed that that's what she told the physician, I want a C-section because this is painful. And the doctor said, I think you should give it some more time and let's get you some pain relief and then let's think about it some more. That's a different situation from the sterile situation 2 weeks earlier or even the day before. And I think that that ought to be taken into consideration.
Ms. Kendall? I want to get the scope of the informed consent statute right now. Does the scope of the informed consent statute that we're dealing with today involve the right to choose?
Yes, it involves the right to choose, but...
Does it give patients the right to choose?
Yes. Yes, it does.
And when does that right cease?
It's the same as my right to swing my arm. I can swing it until I'm going to hit you. And she has the right to make whatever choice she wants,
mm-hmm.
and the doctor has the obligation to give her all the information that she needs to make her choice. And then when she says, well, I've decided I want A, and the doctor says, I really feel that B is the most appropriate thing for you, and she says, well, I really, really want A, and he says, I don't feel comfortable in doing that, I don't think you can compel the physician to do B. She has the right to have A, but she's the one that has to find somebody who's going to go ahead and do it for her.
Well, but counsel, that's easy to say if I'm sitting here and I have a lot of choice. If I'm lying on a table and we've got minutes and to go, I can't very well say, well, give me my cellular phone and I'm going to call around town and bring in a physician who is now going to do a C-section.
I realize, and Judge Mize in his dissent also agreed that is a difficult situation, but...
Yeah. Let me just back up.
Can I continue my question?
Yeah, but let me just finish this.
Sure.
On page 14, that's 215 of the appendix.
Okay.
The trial court held as a matter of law, I am satisfied to determine that once the procedure elected has been initiated, as here, a request for change does not thereby require an informed consent discussion. But as a matter of law, is that your position?
Yes, because nothing had changed. And so the statute 44830 recognizes as one of the exceptions to a physician's right to disclose, or obligation to disclose, a physician doesn't have to tell the patient something they already know. If nothing has changed, there's no reason for him to re-inform her of the risk. And that's why our position is that the request for a new procedure doesn't trigger any obligation on his part to again go over everything that's already been said.
Ms. Tyndall, get back to where I was. A few years back, I had some kidney stones, and the doctor told me that I had two alternatives available to me. One was to get them blasted out of me by putting me in a tub of water and shooting something. The other was a surgical procedure, and I elected to go into the water. Now, once they lowered me in the water, I was certainly unable to get out of that water. But what if, at the time they lowered me into that water, I said to the doctor who was there, ready to go, I said, hey, wait, I don't like this. I think I would rather have the surgical procedure done. Do I have the right to do that? And does that doctor, what's the doctor's duty at that point?
He says, I think you have the right to change your mind at that point.
Mm-hmm.
In labor, you have the... I think you have the right to change your mind unless it's physically impossible. If you're in labor,
right? I'm in that tub of water. I get the first blast and I say, hey, I don't like this. This is terribly uncomfortable. Get me out of here and put me on a table.
I think you can stop. The doctor has to stop at that point because you can be free of that unwarranted intrusion. But can you say, doctor, I don't like having these kidney stones and I want you to stop me having these kidney stones? and force him to make him just go away without any treatment. No.
But how is my example different from what occurred here?
Because the labor was the natural process, and what she was complaining about is the pain of labor was what made her want to have a C-section. And she said, I want a C-section because I want this over with.
What's wrong with that? The pain associated with, I don't like this pain. Get me out of here and put me out and give me a C-section.
All of the experts testified that it was inappropriate to do a C-section simply for pain relief.
So it's the doctor's right to choose?
No, but you have to remember that the doctrine of informed consent is also interested in the medical judgment. The reason why only the doctor has an informed consent obligation, not the hospital, not the nurses, not anyone else, the doctor. And the reason why is because there has to be some medical judgment as to whether or not it's an appropriate procedure. And so the doctors, that's something that the doctors all agree on, that for pain relief, you don't do that surgery. You try and find the patient a medication that gives them pain relief. It's a different...
Well, counsel, wasn't the pain here one that's not generally associated with childbirth? She had abdominal pains that were checked on. They couldn't find an excuse for it or a reason for it, and so, in effect, they were ignoring that. And just doing the birth. So is that a change here?
Well, the trial court considered that specifically and held no, and that the plaintiff's position has always been that this was this excruciating abdominal pain that was very bad. If you look at her testimony, she does say that after a period of time, the pain of labor was worse than the pain from her abdomen. But the abdominal pain, Dr. Figge examined her and concluded that, as best as he could tell, there was no imminent danger from that. It wasn't a uterine rupture. It wasn't a placental previa. And and he testified that he talked to her about it and said, as far as I can see, there's nothing going on. The plaintiffs have said, well, you couldn't rule that out. But the testimony was, and the trial court accepted it, that it was essentially ruled out as well as could be, because nothing's 100% certain. But that didn't change it in the trial court's perspective as the finder of fact, because there was a number of patients who did have a kind of a pain that was associated or that came with the labor and went away when the baby was born that had no apparent cause to it. So that was not, it was an infrequent occurrence, but it was not totally unheard of.
But do you agree then with this sentence from the trial court? I am satisfied to determine that once the procedure elected has been initiated, as here, a request for change does not thereby require an informed consent discussion. You don't agree with that.
I
do. No, because you agreed that Justice Babbage could get out of the hot water.
Well, he said it doesn't require a new informed consent discussion. That doesn't mean that the patient can't change his mind. I guess I read the sentence differently than you.
Okay. So now, didn't she change her mind here at least twice? She told him, go ahead and do a C-section. Once was 8 o'clock in the morning, and once was at 1. Is that right?
No, three times.
Three times. Okay, that makes it even worse.
Mm-hmm. Once is at 8 o'clock in the morning when he first sees her, and she says, gee, I think I've changed my mind. And he says, well, let's see what's going on. And they go in the room, and there's no further discussion, and they both agree that there was no further discussion. And that was never at the trial court, and the trial court notes in its decision, that was never a basis for the plaintiff contending that she should have had, that there was any deprivation of her rights with respect to that incident.
So, counsel, just so I am, once you concede, or let's say we're talking about an extension of the informed consent situation, and that's what the Court of Appeals did, then you're articulating here between Justice Babbage's example and the Chief's example, what standard or rule, I'm listening carefully, where is this? Because it seems to me this is a very difficult area. You're saying, well, in childbirth it's different than in the kidney stone example. So,
I'm sorry, because that's not the impression I mean to give.
Well, that's what I was. Okay, tell me then what rule or standard you think should be used in that.
Well, you have the right to be free from unauthorized intrusions upon your body, and that includes telling your doctor, I don't want you to perform this procedure on me. I'm in the tank and I don't like this. I want to get out. But can you tell your doctor, stop the labor? No, and the reason why is because it's not the doctor that's doing the labor, it's your body. And one of the physical...
But that's not the issue. The issue is, she didn't say stop the labor. She said, give me a C-section.
Give me a C-section because it hurt, the pain is... She wants, that was the objective, to stop the labor.
Could I ask this? Suppose you were Mrs. Schreiber on the morning of June 25th. What would you have said that would have triggered your right to have your choice with C-section under the law?
I think her right is that she has a right to be free of having someone else do something to her body that she doesn't want done. It does not extend to allowing her to compel the physician to perform a surgery. So to effectuate her choice, it's a difficult situation, I agree with Justice Abramson, but she or her husband needed to find somebody who was willing to do that. And I don't think you can compel the physician to stand in a room and perform an hour-long surgery. That impinges his right of bodily integrity.
In other words, she had to find somebody else during labor. She had to find another doc in order to vindicate her choice.
I believe that would be correct. She's in labor. Labor is what happens at the end of a pregnancy. And I'm not saying that, what I'm trying to say is that the natural process of your condition is going to continue. And if you select a mode of treatment that the physician believes is inappropriate, and he doesn't agree that he wants to do that, the patient cannot compel that physician to perform that surgery.
Are you saying under all circumstances? I can understand your argument, and I think this is a great question that Justice Foster put to you about what could she have done? I understand your argument if a C-section was not a viable, reasonable, medically acceptable procedure. But here, at least it seems pretty clear from the record, that a C-section was a reasonable, viable, acceptable medical procedure. What could she have done?
I think that it's incumbent upon her and her coach, usually there's a labor coach, to see if they can find somebody who wants to do what it is that she wants. And I know that sounds harsh, but that's the only way you could protect her right to choose. Because by Dr. Figge saying, well, geez, I don't feel comfortable doing that surgery based on a complaint of pain alone.
Well, maybe the obligation was the doctor's to say, you have three times asked me for a C-section. And I have twice told you it's not appropriate, and I will tell you now the third time, and I am now telling you I am not going to do a C-section. If you and your husband want a C-section, then it is your obligation to have another physician come in, because I am not going to do that.
Well, but he didn't say that.
But should he have said that? And is that his obligation to tell her, to alert her, that he wasn't ever going to do it?
That wasn't the case. What he said was, look, I think that you can do this. I think you should give it more time. Let's try the Pitocin, and let's see how this goes. And if it doesn't work, then we can do the C-section. He wasn't saying, I'm never doing that C-section for you. He was trying to advocate to tell her, come on, keep going, you can do this. And if that kind of advocacy by a doctor is seen as a deprivation of a choice, I think we're going to turn doctors into people who say, these are your choices, pick one. And I think patients want more from their doctor than that. They want to have a recommendation as to what they think should be done.
Well, then basically your position is he kept informing her and she agreed.
That was his testimony. He said, I told her that I thought she should give it more time. The Court of Appeals decision said he encouraged her to hang on and she just didn't respond. And so he thought she was okay with what he was recommending. And
if she had wanted a C-section, then she should have said to him, enough is enough, do it now or get somebody to do it.
That was what the Court of Appeals concluded. My time is up.
You may finish your response.
Dr. Figge testified that if she had persisted in her request for a C-section, and this was as he was giving the Pitocin, that he would have done the C-section. So that was what our position was at trial, was that if the request had continued to persist, he would have gone ahead with it, although not necessarily just solely for pain relief. My time is up.
Thank you, counsel. Representing the plaintiffs is Attorney Weiss. Mr. Weiss.
Thank you. Welcome to the Northwoods. I also have with me today John Krieger, who is the guardian ad litem and actively participated in this case. I think that it's necessary in order to properly understand the issues here to correct what I think might be some maybe not inaccuracies about the facts, but certainly the context of the facts that may be somewhat misleading. And those facts mainly have to do with the state of mind of Mrs. Schreiber on the day that the decisions were made and communicated to Dr. Figge. And I'd like to talk about this because this case ultimately comes down to who has the right to choose. And I think that that right is so well established in our law, not only on the informed consent basis, but on a constitutional basis, that right cannot be questioned. And I hear today that I guess that right isn't questioned, that the position is that Janice Schreiber does have the right to choose. And that's, we believe, the ultimate question that the court has to ask. But let's put this a little bit in context. And I can do that, I think, very quickly.
Well, I think, don't you differ, though? At the starting point, she's got the right to choose. I think, as Ms. Tyndall says, we stop, but that right to choose ceases at some point far shorter than what you would say.
That's exactly correct. That's what their position is, that at some point in time, once you sign that consent to say that I'm going to try something else, that at that point in time, you then lose the right to choose in some way. That is their position. And I cannot see that in any way is consistent with Wisconsin law. I think that you always have the right if you're capable of making the choice. And by the way, there was never any defense raised in this case that Mrs. Schreiber was not capable of making the choice. That was never raised in this case.
Well, was it raised that she didn't make the choice because she just kept going along with the doctor and that was the fact situation?
At trial, there was an attempt, although not a strident attempt, to make that position. The fundamental position of Dr. Figge at trial is that once he obtained the consent for the VBAC, his only obligation was to medically manage the case and that the wishes of the patient didn't matter. There was some slight underlying secondary defense that said, well, and by the way, we don't think that she was strident enough. However, the trial court, which obviously wasn't predisposed to the plaintiff's case because they found against us, the trial court found that consent was denied to her very clearly, and that factual finding was upheld by the Court of Appeals, and obviously the trial court was the one that had the opportunity to see those witnesses. And when you review the factual record, that is really very clear, because what happens at noon is that Mrs. Schreiber is in this frame of mind. Mrs. Schreiber knows that in her first pregnancy, which went 36 hours, that labor didn't develop the way it was supposed to, that even after augmentation with Pitocin, it didn't develop the way that it was supposed to, and after 36 hours, she ended up with a C-section. She knows that when she decided, and all she decided in this case was to give the VBAC a try, with the understanding that she could always get a C-section if it was not going the way she wanted. Even by 8 o'clock in the morning, she sensed, knowing her own body, that her labor was going the same way that it did originally. And that's what prompted the comment at 8 o'clock to the doctor that said, listen, why don't we just do a C-section? I think this is going the same way. I've been in labor now for some 8 hours before that time. Things are going the same way. Well, the doctor said basically no, gave her an amniotomy and to stimulate her labor.
Could I ask you, counsel, your position is that the doctor violated the informed consent statute?
Correct.
Did he violate the informed consent statute at 8 o'clock when the request was made?
We never made that contention at trial, and frankly, don't make it now, except that...
Well, but I want an answer for you now.
Did he violate it at 8 o'clock?
Yes.
I think that the context, if the 8 o'clock discussion was the only discussion that would have been had that day, we wouldn't be here. Because I think that it's a very reasonable read of the record to say that at 8 o'clock in the morning, she acquiesced to the continuation of treatment. That was a fairly short discussion. She was not very demanding in the way in which she went about.
Doesn't that mean a subjective standard? Didn't she clearly ask for a C-section at 8 o'clock in the morning?
She did ask for a C-section at 8 o'clock in the morning. The doctor basically said, no, I think what we should do is stimulate your labor. I'm going to do an amniotomy, and she didn't say anything further. But then when you combine that, Justice, with what happened at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, which is at noon, she sends the nurse to tell the doctor that he's going to get in there and do a C-section. That's what prompts him coming in at 1 o'clock. A very demanding thing for her to do. And when he gets there at 1 o'clock, that's exactly what she communicates to him. And he brushes her off. So then within a half an hour of that time, she says to him again, I want a C-section and I want it now. And then he not only brushes her off, but he brushes her off in what the trial court found to be a rude and dismissive manner, a very brusque manner. He says, well, if I did a C-section for every woman that wanted it, that's all I'd be doing. And the testimony of Mrs. Schreiber at that point was, and very credible to the trial court, and he found that, was that she felt there was nothing else that she could do. There was nothing else that she could do. She had made the demand. She'd made the demand twice adamantly within the course of a half an hour. So, and one of the important things to me here is that demand was not in any way irrational.
I'm just waiting. So, listening to Attorney Tindall articulate the standard she would like this court to use, and listening to Justice Cross's question, you know, this whatever we write here, whoever wins, we're going to be writing for not just, delivery and labor situations, but many different procedures. And what troubles me about this case is that I think everyone, patients and physicians, need some level standard, something to operate on. And I'm hearing kind of passing in the night here discussion. And I'm just wondering at what level, and you heard her talk about the intrusiveness and the battery, what is your opinion of where this informed consent would stop? In other words, the doctor is the expert, the patient that relies on his or her advice, and what do you think the standard or rule should be then?
Well, I think the rule itself is a really simple rule, and I guess I can articulate this in two ways, by telling you what I think the rule should be, and then telling you what I think a decision like this should set forth to say what it doesn't mean, because that's just as important here, and I think that's one of the big objections that the defense has. I think the rule is a very simple rule, and that is that a patient has the right to select a reasonable method of treatment at any time when selection of that right is not going to impair the doctor's ability to effectuate the treatment. That's a little bit wordy, but practically speaking, in this case, the only time when she wouldn't have had the right to select the treatment is once she was at the end stages of labor, where a cesarean would no longer have been viable. If it's a reasonable medical alternative to do it, and the patient is capable of consent, none of the exceptions to 448.30 apply, then the doctor has to respect the choice of the patient.
I'm with you at that point. The problem that I have, however, to this point is whether or not, or what is a reasonable medical alternative. Now, I know in your brief you say that Ms. Tindall didn't raise this until appeal, but there is a section in her brief on page 35, not 30, that says this was not a reasonable medical alternative. And you, of course, say it is.
Yes.
He's right.
Let me move over the mic here. This is the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology bulletin on VBACs that was in force and effect in July, or on June, at the time that this birth took place. This is their very bulletin. And the last paragraph of the bulletin, in talking about exactly this situation, says, because risk of labor has not been assessed for patients with more than one prior cesarean birth with a low vertical uterine scar, exactly our situation, the guidelines do not apply to these situations. Now, there was a later guideline, also went into evidence, that came out in October after the birth. And it said, for patients who have had one prior cesarean sections, we tell them that we should encourage them to have a VBAC. But for patients for two or more, you can't encourage them, because there wasn't enough data to know how safe they were. The reason that I bring this up, Justice Babbage, is that not only was a cesarean section a reasonable medical alternative. It was the ordinary medical alternative under these circumstances. This was the first time that Dr. Figge had ever attempted to do a VBAC with a patient who had had two or more prior cesarean sections. Every other one he had done.
Mr. Weiss, if that was indeed the case, why didn't you proceed with a regular medical negligence claim here instead of going with the informed consent claim?
We did, and that's a very good question. And we looked at this case in advance of trial when we anticipated trying it to a jury. And I won't go through all of the history which precedes that. And essentially our analysis, Justice Crooks, was this. When the depositions were all taken in this case, there were two sets of experts. The plaintiff's expert said that the standard of care mandated, it required that he do a C-section because of this severe abdominal pain, which was a harbinger of a uterine rupture or placental separation. That was our experts. The defense expert said, no, that severe abdominal pain, even though it was unusual, did not require that a C-section be done. You don't have to do a C-section. All of the doctors agreed that a C-section is a perfectly appropriate approach, a very normal approach, and in fact, the overwhelmingly used approach in these circumstances. All the doctors agreed to that. But the defense doctor said, you don't have to do one. Well, we took a look at that, and 1023, the medical malpractice instruction, says that if the doctor selects between two reasonable methods of treatment, that he can't be found negligent. And here are these defense doctors, very well qualified, who say it was okay for him not to do the C-section. On the other hand, we look at the informed consent statute, and we look at that in light of Mrs. Schreiber's three requests, the last two being very forceful requests for a cesarean section. And what is Janice Schreiber's right? Her right is to select among the reasonable alternative methods of treatment. So when we looked at that, we concluded that informed consent was the very rational approach to take, because instead of fighting this battle, it is her choice. And that's the only reason it was abandoned. It wasn't abandoned because we felt we couldn't prove it. It was abandoned because we felt that informed consent was cleaner.
As an extension of Justice Crook's question, he asked, why not negligence? You opted for the statute. Let me extend on that. Why not the doctrine of the common law right to bodily integrity, the doctrine of the common law right to informed consent, rather than bringing it under a statute, which arguably has nothing to say about what the doctor's actions must be, other than to inform?
Well, I think that the pleadings do not specifically assert and only assert 44830, and we ended up going back through all the piles of briefs that have been filed in this case. We have argued that both the common law right of informed consent, along with the statutory codification of it, have been violated. But we haven't made a lot of distinction of that, because I think that both the legislative history from 44830 and the case law subsequent from 44830 have made it clear that 44830 was not intended to restrict any rights that a patient has, but rather to codify them into a statute.
Is it your response, in part then, a response you could give to Judge Mize, as I recall reading his dissent? He was concerned that he would say, okay, here's an informed consent statute that you're proceeding under. Show me where the words are that can compel a doctor to do something he doesn't want to do. And that he doesn't argue, as you advance, that the patient has the right to choose. In fact, everyone seems to be saying, sure, the patient has a right to choose. The question is, can a patient compel a doctor? Can the patient's right to choose take away the doctor's right to choose not to be part of the procedure? I mean, that's kind of what it boils down to. But where in the statute do you find the words that would say a doctor's actions to perform a procedure can be compelled under this statute?
Yeah, under that statute you will not find it, but under the legislative history from 44830, the case law which precedes it and comes subsequent to it, that, as the Court of Appeals says, that right is inherent in the statute. The statute, which is designed to give you enough information so that you can make a reasonable choice, would have no meaning if you were deprived of that choice. That's, in essence, what the Court of Appeals said.
Why did you not proceed under the common law doctrine? Are you saying you
I mean, you don't seem to be arguing it here. Maybe you did before. Why aren't you arguing it? Then you could get rid of the problem. You don't see words in the statute that Judge Myers had.
I think that we always have argued it, that the doctrine of informed consent has, there are two places where we look for those rules. Number one is 44830, but even the legislature in enacting 44830 said we also look to the case law. And I think that the case law makes that right of self-determination very, very, very obvious. And you bring up another point that it's very important for me to address. And I apologize to a degree, because as these things evolve, you know, you see the briefs, there are positions that get taken that are new positions, and one of them that the defense has raised here is this idea that the doctor can't be compelled to take an affirmative procedure. That's really cropped up mostly in the Supreme Court. And I want to try to articulate our position with respect to that. The failure here of Dr. Figge is not his failure to do a cesarean section. And I may be guilty of even kind of stating that in the briefs, because that's ultimately what should have been done. His failure of informed consent here is not to honor the choice of the patient. And the easiest way for him to honor the choice of the patient, since the routine practice was to do a C-section, was for him to just do it. And since it wasn't an unethical thing to do, it was the normal procedure in these cases, something he'd done 100 times before. That's the way that we've presented it sometimes in the briefs, but that's really not quite technically correct. The right is Janice Schreiber's right. Dr. Figge had some obligations here, but his obligations were, I think, as Justice Babish points out, at a minimum, if he's not going to perform the C-section, and he had her sign, four in the morning, he had her sign a consent for a cesarean section. So here's Janice Schreiber. Her attitude is, I'm going to give this a try. She's asked to sign a consent for a C-section, fully believes that the doctor will perform one if she wants one. And then what happens? Well, we find out now, subsequently, that he was unwilling to do one. At a minimum, when she makes the request for the reasonable alternative treatment, the doctor has to say to her, if he's not going to get a doctor in, he has to say to her, I'm not going to do it. You have the right to it, but I'm not going to do it. And you've got the right to have another doctor who will do it. And I think under these circumstances, where she always believed he would do it, he had done it to her twice before, she had no reason to believe that he wouldn't. I think under those circumstances, probably, he had an obligation to, you know, to call another doctor in if he really had a problem with doing it himself. That isn't what was going on here, though. What was going on here is not that Dr. Figge had some grave reservations about doing a C-section. It's very apparent from the record that he simply thought that a VBAC was better. So he was compelling Janice to go along with his choice. And that's the real problem that we have with the case.
Okay. Now, I've read your statement of issues and the insurance company's statement of the issues. And they're different. But after I looked at them, I thought they really came down to whether or not there's a medically recognized reasonable form of treatment, that there was an alternative here. And then I read the trial court's second decision, I think it is. And he says he doesn't have to decide that. He doesn't decide that issue. So even if you prevail, and we use that standard, is there a decision here that there was a reasonably recognized method? See, as the other side says this, it wasn't medically indicated. You say it was medically indicated, or that both could have been medically indicated.
I presented to the court a statute that I, frankly, was not aware of the existence of, and I've given it to you today, which defines for the purposes of 44830. For some reason, it's in another section of the statutes. Section 18, what viable medical alternative means.
This is in a rule.
Yes, and my reading of Judge Karch's decision, and I would have to pull it out, but my understanding always was from reading the decision, if not directly the text, the context of the decision, that, well, Judge Karch essentially found what the defense experts would have said in a medical negligence case. In other words, that a cesarean was not mandated, and that he didn't feel that there was enough change in circumstances to require another discussion with Janice, which is very different than whether he had to respect her consent. But I do think, and I've always felt, and I'd have to look at the decision again, that both that decision and the Court of Appeals decision recognized that a C-section was a viable medical alternative. The record before all of the courts has shown that every doctor has agreed to it, every doctor acknowledges the ACOG standards, every doctor agreed that the ordinary method of delivery for somebody who'd had two prior cesareans was to do it by cesarean. That was the normal method at that time. So I don't think there's really any question. Dr. Figge tried to say, well, once labor started, I kind of used a different ball field. But the fact of the matter is that all of the risks that result in the ACOG standards are still present. You know, the only question is whether you've got a low uterine scar, whether you've had two prior cesareans. The risk of uterine rupture is during labor. So, you know, nobody really contested that at trial. And
Counsel, I have not read the record. I read Judge Mize's dissent in which he uses four different terms. He says that the C-section was contraindicated. He said the C-section was bad medical practice. He said a C-section was not medically indicated. He also said that a C-section was inadvisable. Those are all quotes. What did Dr. Figge testify to? I understand that he testified at the very least that a C-section was not medically indicated. Is that in the record?
That's in the record.
Did he say any of these other terms, that it was bad medical practice?
No. I think every doctor was... I'm virtually certain that every doctor was asked this question in one form or another. It would have been within the standard of care to do a C-section at any time during her labor, right up until the time a C-section was done. And I think every doctor said yes, it would have been. You know, recognizing the ACOG standards, recognizing the inherent risks of vaginal delivery. And the reason that's important, Justice, is if you take a look at Chapter 18, viable medical alternative is used in 44830, it modifies the term medical modes of treatment, means modes of treatment generally considered by the medical profession to be within the scope of current acceptable standards of care.
Okay, so, well, let me stay with my question for a moment. Assuming that Dr. Figge's only testimony is that in his opinion, a C-section was not medically indicated, that's quote, medically indicated, end of quote. It sounds to me like you're getting into medical malpractice here, because he's got his judgment is that it's not indicated at this point to give. You're saying that even though that's his good faith belief, and I take it that was his good faith belief, that nevertheless he had to overcome his own judgment, his own medical judgment, that this was not medically indicated, and go ahead and perform the C-section.
You raise a very good point, and the distinction is this. Dr. Figge's testimony, in a nutshell, was this. In my medical judgment, I thought that it was better to go forward with a VBAC. Therefore, a cesarean was not medically indicated. My medical judgment said it was better to go forward with a VBAC, and since it was my medical judgment to do so, I didn't feel that anything that was happening with Mrs. Schreiber in the morning changed my judgment in that regard. Therefore, I didn't feel that there was an indication to me for a cesarean. On the other hand, he also freely admitted that a cesarean was a reasonable medical alternative and that nobody could be criticized for doing that. Now, the reason that that's critical to me is this. One of the things that this case boils down to is the difference in perspective between someone like Janice Schreiber and Dr. Figge. And what that boils down to me is the protect the baby rule. If my wife and I are making a decision to have a C-section, and this is the situation in this case, and the doctor tells us, listen, if you go forward with a VBAC, the risks to the baby are higher, but the risks to you are lower in this situation, because a uterine rupture can result in the kind of injury that we had here or the death of the child, and that's the risk of going forward with a VBAC. But I can tell you, the risks of going forward with a C-section, it's much better for the baby, but it's much higher for you. And you've got to make the decision which it is. Well, the doctor may very rationally choose to make that decision, looking at both baby and mother, to go forward with the VBAC, which is what Dr. Figge was saying. But the mother, on the other hand, may very rationally say, I am willing to take that risk to protect the child.
And so under your proposed rule, the mother has the right to trump the doctor's judgment, and so long as what she is trumping it with is the alternative of a reasonable medical alternative.
Absolutely. That's a much better articulation of the rule than I could have stated. And let me make a couple of distinctions for you here. A woman who comes in a first-time pregnancy, there is no ACOG bulletin that says that the normal route to deliver it is by C-section. So a woman who comes in a first-time pregnancy and is laying on the table and says, geez, I don't like this labor pain, this is something that really bothers me, do a C-section. Doctor has absolutely no obligation under our position to do one. And I think the court should state so if you find favorably for us in this decision. The Court of Appeals so stated. Because a C-section under those circumstances is not a reasonable medical alternative. It's not within the patient's right to select. And a doctor, in my judgment, does not have to do that within the informed consent doctrine. But here, we have not only a viable medical alternative, we have a doctor who's doing it different than the way he's always done it before. And he's essentially doing the unusual practice in this case, and she's asking for the normal procedure. Not only a normal procedure, but a procedure that she's been through twice before. She knows what it's about. She's comfortable with it. And at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, she's saying to herself very rationally, this is going just the way it was with my first boy. I don't want to have 36 hours of labor. I have this severe abdominal pain that scares me with respect to what's going on with this baby. I do not want to take any chances anymore. I'm willing to take chances of the operation because I know what that's about, and that's what I want to do. That was a very rational thing for her to do, and I think it would be a terrible decision for our court system to say to a patient that they don't have the right to make that decision.
I understood Justice Babbage to say that the patient gets the right to trump the doctor's decision so long as it is a reasonable medical alternative. Is that objective or subjective, that clause, so long as it is a reasonable medical alternative?
No, I think that's objective. In other words, I think that it's the obligation of the plaintiff to prove that it is a reasonable medical alternative. In order to show that the patient has the right to select.
But isn't that true even though the patient makes it abundantly clear that they want something that might not be a reasonable medical alternative?
Well, in certain circumstances, for instance, you have the right in Wisconsin, even if you're mentally incompetent. Let's say that I'm dying from appendicitis and I'm mentally incompetent. The Wisconsin court has said that the right to self-determination of your own body is so important that a physician under those circumstances can't go in and do the operation unless you've got the consent. In that case, the patient has the right to make a choice that, even if it isn't a viable medical alternative, to tell the doctor, no, you can't invade. Now, I'm not asking the court, within the context of this case, to go that far, because it's not necessary for the court to go that far here.
You would determine reasonable medical alternatives by bringing in expert witnesses of what's accepted in the medical community.
Certainly, and I think that is important, because we do not ask this court to find, for instance, that with a first-time mom, that a doctor would would be treatment on demand, and that would be wrong. A doctor does not have to go forward and do this kind of procedure at all on a patient when it's not a reasonable medical alternative. But that, frankly, just was not an issue here, and the ACOG standards available at the time made that, I think, abundantly clear.
Well, then, do you agree with this statement of the issue, and that this is what the court should answer? Must a physician perform a procedure which he or she does not believe is medically indicated? That's what Figge testified, right?
Yes.
And which he does not desire to do, she didn't want to do at that time. If the patient selects a reasonable medical alternative mode of treatment.
My time's up, but I'll respond if you'll give me permission to do so. No, I would not agree that that's the issue.
Okay. Tell me what you think the issue is.
I think the issue is, in a circumstance where a reasonable medical alternative exists and the doctor and patient disagree as to which reasonable alternative is best, who has the right to choose? And the reason that I say that, Justice Abramson, is that, again, I don't think the rule should be that a doctor necessarily has to be compelled to do the procedure, but the doctor has to give the patient the right to choose. and then, you know, inform the patient that either some other doctor will do it or the patient has a right to obtain another physician.
So the reason you object to that statement of the question, which is the question, the statement of the other side in their brief, is because you don't think this is an issue of what the doctor has to do.
That's correct. I think it's an issue of what the patient has the right to choose rather than what the doctor has to do. And this birth could have occurred by Dr. Figge saying to him, listen, you can get another physician to do this. I would rather not do it. And she could have said, yeah, Dr. Figge testified that he knew full well that if he presented that issue to her, that's what she was going to do. And that was one of the reasons he didn't directly offer her the choice, just denied her then.
What if there isn't another physician available?
Well, and if there's not another physician available under the circumstances of this case, where the consents were signed, where he'd done the C-sections before, where she had every right to believe that he would do the C-section, I think then he would have had to do it. I think then he would have had to do it under our informed consent law. But that's an extraordinarily rare circumstance. Even in the small rural community that I live in, I don't think that virtually ever raised itself.
Thank you, Mr. Weiss. Ms. Tindall, you have several minutes for rebuttal.
One important, really important point that needs to be kept in mind here is that all the doctors testified that once the patient selected a VBAC and went into labor, the labor was just like any other labor, like the labor of a first-time mother. It wasn't any different. So while the plaintiff contends that it was always medically accepted, medically acceptable to do a C-section on this patient because she always had the medical indication of two prior C-sections, and that continued throughout. He says, because of that, that means that at any time, that she had the right to have a C-section, and it was always a choice that was open to her and always medically acceptable. But that just ignores the testimony that all the doctors agreed to, that once you're in labor, that labor is treated like any other labor, like the labor of a first-time mother. Now, doctors don't offer a first-time mother the choice of a C-section while they're in labor, just for pain relief. And that's a medical judgment that physicians have made. And if this court concludes that a physician has to offer a mother who's had a C-section, who's now in labor, has to offer a C-section as a method of pain relief during the course of labor, then there's no qualitative difference and there's no reason why that shouldn't apply to a first-time mother. And I think the plaintiff is overlooking how important that testimony is, that the one you begin labor, you're treated like any other person. Plaintiff says, no, when you have a VBAC, the ordinary procedure at that time was to do a C-section. That was the ordinary procedure prior to 1988 was to do a C-section or a pedelective C-section before the patient ever went into labor. But once the patient goes into labor, things have changed. And that's something that's completely overlooked.
Is it your position then that there was no reasonable medical alternative then?
That's my position. It wasn't a reasonable alternative, medical alternative at the time because of the additional risk it presented and because this labor was to be treated like any other labor.
What did the trial court say?
The trial court didn't specifically address that because it wasn't...
He didn't think it was important to address it, as I read it, because he was going to make the decision that once the procedure started... that there was no going back because it was in the doctor's hands unless, and I'm reading this into it, unless there was a significant change of condition.
It wasn't that so much. He said on page 8 of his decision, he says they advocated as point number 2 of their points that should have been. The whole issue at trial was did he give her the information, and point number 2 that plaintiff argued was the plaintiff wasn't told that there was no going back. And on page 8 of his decision, he says, as to the second point, the defendant did not adopt this position. Defendant never said there's no going back. What defendant said was, well, you know, there's no obligation to give another discussion and to offer another choice unless there's something that has changed. The defense position was the patient does have a right to change his or her mind, but, you know, the doctor also has a right to advocate to the patient what he or she thinks should be done. And it just wasn't an issue in that respect.
This is here on summary judgment. If we should send this back for trial, if we hold against you, are you going to, I guess what you're saying is that you think an issue yet to be resolved is whether or not a C-section was a reasonable medical alternative.
I'm sorry.
You're after trial.
This